Welcome to Nightlife, the podcast.
Well, if you happen to be with me in the wee small hours of Monday morning last weekend, we were having a fascinating conversation with a science writer, Michael Marshall. It was about how viruses have played a really important part in our evolution. It's thought, for example, an ancient virus basically created the genome that gave us and other mammals placentas. So we've got an unknown virus to thank for that. Now, certain viruses, which are called retroviruses, can put their own genetic material into the genome of the person or animal that they've infected and change it. There are only a handful of known retroviruses around at the moment. The most famous of these is the HIV virus, which of course changes a person's immune system responses. But Michael was explaining to us last week that none of the retroviruses we know about at the moment are able to be passed down from generation to generation. But he did tell us that there's a retrovirus affecting Australia's koalas that is causing changes in koala DNA and is being passed down. He couldn't tell us much more. So I've found Dr. Michaela Blyton to talk to us tonight. Michaela's from the University of Queensland's Institute for Bioengineering and Nanotechnology. She's one of the scientists who found that this retrovirus called CORV is one of the reasons why so many koalas are suffering from chlamydia, which is one of the big problems that koala populations in Australia are facing. Hello, Michaela. Welcome to Nightlife.
Hello. Good to be with you.
So how apt would it be, Michaela, to call this sort of koala AIDS, if you will, as a way for us to understand it?
Yeah, I think it's a fair description of CORV. Like HIV, it seems to be associated with a high level of disease in koalas, and particularly with chlamydia. We know that chlamydia is the number one disease that's threatening koala populations, particularly in Queensland and New South Wales. But one of the things that we've wondered is, you know, why is it that these populations face such high rates of chlamydia? Whereas koalas down in South Australia and Victoria, while chlamydia is there, it doesn't affect them so much. And we think it's because of this retrovirus, CORV, that is causing immune suppression and lowering the animal's ability to fight off the chlamydia.
So how long have scientists known that koalas have this retrovirus, CORV?
So CORV's been known about for about 20 years now. But it's a rather complicated virus and we're still trying to figure out a lot of what it does. The way it was actually discovered was from a vet who was seeing a lot of koalas, particularly in captivity, that seemed to have really high rates of cancer. And he wondered, why is it that koalas have a high rate of cancer compared to other animal species? And he went looking for the cause and found CORV. And so we know now that CORV not only causes immune suppression and increases susceptibility to infectious diseases, but it also increases the cancer burden that koalas have.
Oh, poor koalas. Now, as I said, we were talking about retroviruses on the show last week, which is where I first heard about a CORV. But we were hearing that the human ones, and I guess HIV AIDS is the one that we are most familiar with. And one of the good things was always that it couldn't actually be passed on genetically. Is it the case with CORV that it is actually changing koala DNA and is being passed down to younger generations?
Yeah, that's right. So that's what makes CORV so complicated. So we think about most retroviruses, such as HIV, as being transmitted between individuals, you know, in a similar way to things like flu, things like COVID, that they might be transmitted by aerosols, they could be sexually transmitted, but they're not actually, you know, written into a person's DNA and they're not passed down in that way. On the other hand, we have a whole bunch of what we call endogenous retroviruses, which are really old insertions of viruses into the genomes of humans and animals, but they're degraded, they're non-functional, they don't do anything, or they're actually co-opted, like you heard last week, by the host for functions such as building the placenta. But in the case of CORV, it's actually both. So it's transmitted between individuals, it's functional, it's active, but it's also in their genome and it's passed down from the mother and the father to the offspring in the same way as any of your genes are passed down.
So any koala who is born from the group of koalas who have CORV is going to be compromised, their immune system's basically compromised from the get-go, from the moment they're born.
Yeah, there's a good chance that they will be. And what we know is that even those versions of the virus that are not in the genome, because there are different subtypes of CORV, the same as we have different variants of COVID-19, such as Delta or Omicron, we have different subtypes of CORV. And some subtypes are more virulent than others. But those ones that are not actually in the genome and nonetheless passed down from mother to Joey, potentially through the milk or potentially even through pap feeding, which is a process where the Joey feeds on the mother's feces around the time of pouch emergence in order to be inoculated with their microbiome. But it's quite possible that during that process, they're also picking up CORV.
So does that mean, Michaela, that there are some koala populations who don't have CORV and some that are, and that's how you can actually look at the different DNA of all these koalas and go, these particular koalas are actually genetically different to the other ones?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different levels. So first of all, the koalas in South Australia and Victoria, they don't seem to have a functional version of the virus in their genome, unlike the ones in New South Wales and Queensland. Every single koala that we have looked at, and we've looked at hundreds and hundreds of koalas now in New South Wales and Queensland, every single one of them have a functional version of the virus in their genome. But this isn't the case in Victoria and South Australia. But what's really interesting with even those koalas that are in New South Wales and Queensland is where the virus is in the genome is not consistent between individuals. So, you know, one individual might have the virus inserted on chromosome 1 and another koala has it inserted in chromosome 5. And that difference is where it's located in the genome can make quite a difference to what effect CORV has. Because if it's inserted right next to an oncogene that causes cancer, then it could lead those animals to have a higher susceptibility to cancer. Whereas if it just happens to insert in a non-functional part of the genome, it might have very little effect at all.
Dr. Michaela Blyton is my guest from the University of Queensland Institute for Bioengineering and Nanotechnology. So, Michaela, are researchers then actively trying to keep, you know, New South Wales koalas separate from Victorian and South Australian koalas, lest, you know, those koalas also catch CORV?
Yeah, I mean, it's an ongoing question for us because one thing that's quite important is that, you know, Victorian and South Australian koalas, they actually were almost completely wiped out through hunting, and they were reintroduced to mainland Australia from offshore islands such as French Island, which is off Melbourne. And as a result of this, those populations have really low genetic diversity, and this can cause problems like inbreeding. And so we have discussed the possibility of actually translocating koalas from Queensland and New South Wales, where they have more genetic diversity, down into Victoria and South Australia to increase it so that we can get rid of these problems of inbreeding. But the problem with doing that is if we do that, we take CORV with it. So we do have to be really careful when we're moving koalas around and trying to, you know, save the species from some problems, that we're not actually creating new problems.
Geez, the poor koalas can't take a trick, can they? Michaela, yeah. How long do researchers think the koala population has had CORV?
That's a very good question, and we don't have an answer to that, not an exact answer. We can say that it's less than 50,000 years, which might sound a very big time range, but in the case of a retrovirus inserted into the genome, it means that CORV is really, really young. It's really recent, and because of this, the koalas haven't had time to adapt to it being inserted into their genome, and they haven't developed a really effective way of suppressing the virus, which is one of the reasons that the virus is still functional, it's still active, and it's still causing disease.
Ah, so if the with the summation or I guess the idea be that if the koalas had had it for a lot longer, then they will have adapted, and so you can see the damage that it's doing, and that's evidence of how young it is.
Yeah, that's right. And it's actually really interesting, you know, from a scientific perspective, because it is the youngest known retrovirus to be inserted into an animal's genome. And so, as I mentioned before, we have quite a few viruses such as HIV that are transmitted between individuals. We also have these really old elements that are in our genomes and the genomes of all animals. But that process by which it goes from one to another, we know very little about it because it's not happening in real time, except where we're talking about CORV. It is happening in real time. And by studying CORV, we're understanding that process a lot better and understanding how it has affected the genomes of all animals.
So is there any way of treating koalas for CORV to get rid of it so that it can't be transmitted or passed on?
The short answer is no. We can't get rid of CORV. But what we can do is potentially try and limit the effect that it has. So I mentioned before that there are different subtypes and that some of those subtypes seem to be more virulent. They cause more disease. And lucky for the koalas, those ones aren't incorporated into their genome. So through selective breeding, we do have the potential to prevent those subtypes from being passed on to the next generation. We also have the ability to potentially develop things like antiretroviral treatments that can suppress the virus. So this would be particularly used in a clinical setting. You get an animal in that's really suffering from chlamydia or another disease and they just can't get on top of it. If we give them antiretroviral treatments during that time, it may suppress the retrovirus and allow their immune system to actually start fighting the diseases such as chlamydia. So there are things that we can do, but we can't get rid of it. It is something that koalas have to live with.
Just astounding, Michaela, to think of the plight of koalas. You know, you're talking about things getting in and giving these animals, you know, drugs and looking after them so that we can ensure that this population survives. So chlamydia is the main disease from which many of these koalas are suffering then as a result of their immune systems being so vulnerable. What are the impacts then on the koala population of so many of them having chlamydia?
Yeah, so, I mean, chlamydia is a double whammy, basically, for koalas. I mean, it's a devastating disease, particularly in females. It causes infections that lead to massive cysts on the ovaries, a thickened uterus. It can also lead to bladder infections, but they're typically referred to as wet bottom because they actually, their bladder gets so damaged that they actually start leaking and they have incontinence, and then they can get secondary infections for that. And so all of that can lead and ultimately will lead to the koalas dying. So obviously we have an effect of mortality. But secondary to that, because it is an infection of the reproductive system, these animals, even if they do manage to keep it at a level where they don't succumb to it, they're generally infertile, which means we do have these populations that are essentially aging. They don't have any new recruitment of individuals into the population, and the animals that are there are just getting older and older, and once they die, that population's going to be gone. There are some populations in inland New South Wales and some areas in southeast Queensland where infection rates are as high as 80, 90% of the population.
Good grief, wow.
Yes, it's just devastating these populations.
So, Makata, when we hear all of these arguments about vegetation clearing, the loss of native habitat, is chlamydia a bigger threat to the future of koalas in Queensland and New South Wales than those other issues, or is it all just a perfect storm making it really difficult to see the koalas' survival long term?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head when you said it's the perfect storm. We know that these things are interrelated. So, yes, disease is in particularly in some populations is devastating them. And even if they have, you know, all the habitat in the world, if we can't bring the disease rate down, those populations aren't going to survive. But what we do know is that the connection between disease, between corv, is not independent of the environment. And I think the perfect example of that is the Gunnedah population of koalas. That population used to be very healthy, and it used to be at a good population density. And then increasingly, we in that region, we have had a series of really bad heat waves. And the koalas obviously are badly affected by the heat waves themselves. They don't have enough water. They don't have enough to drink. And as a result, they can actually die of overheating. But what we've seen alongside these heat waves is a really big increase in the incidence of chlamydia, such that this population now has 80 to 90% chlamydia rate in that population. So in that population, it's declining because of the disease, but the disease is being really strongly influenced by these heat wave events, which are probably connected to climate change. And it's all about, I mean, you can think about it in terms of humans as well, that people, when they're stressed, when they're run down, when things aren't going well, they're more likely to get sick. And the same is the case for koalas.
My guest is Dr. Makayla Blyton, University of Queensland Institute for Bioengineering and Nanotechnology. Now, there is something fascinating that you are working on, because if you're trying to give antibiotics to a koala, you need to be careful of what happens to its microbiome, because they've got a huge gut compared to us, don't they?
Yeah, they certainly do. We joke that basically a koala is just a big bag of guts. Yeah, I mean, it would be no surprise to anyone that, you know, koalas are a eucalypt specialist. They're a really specialist feeder. And eucalypts are really high in toxins. They're really high in fiber and they're really low in protein. So they're a really hard diet for an animal to live on. And because of this, they're really heavily reliant on their microbiome, and their microbiome helps them digest this pretty unpalatable diet. Now, that means that when you do give them antibiotics for chlamydia in particular, other infections too, but as we know, chlamydia is the number one infection that koalas have, that basically those antibiotics also knock down their microbiome. And then the koalas are unable to digest their food properly, and they can actually end up dying from something called gut dysbiosis. And so we've got this added problem that the treatments that we're using at the moment to try and save koalas from chlamydia are actually killing them.
So to get this special microbiome that they have, there's something quite interesting that happens when the baby koalas are about 6 months old. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's right. So because this microbiome is so critical to them to digest their food, it's really important that they get the right microbiome, you know, because if they don't have those right microbes, then they're not going to be able to feed on the eucalyptus leaves. And what we also know from other work that we've done is that once they have their microbiome as an adult, it doesn't change. It doesn't matter if they go and eat a different species of eucalypt or move to a different area. They're kind of stuck with the microbiome that they get when they develop. And so because of this, koalas have evolved a really interesting strategy where basically around the time of pouch emergence, which is about 6 months, when the joey's just starting to come out of the pouch, just starting to nibble on eucalyptus leaves after feeding on the mother's milk, then the mother actually produces a special type of feces, which we call PAP. It's a lot softer. It's quite runny, but it's also really high in bacterial density. And it also contains a high proportion of rare microbes. And then the joey feeds on this pap, and that is how their gut gets inoculated with the right microbes they need to then develop on to feeding on eucalyptus.
Right. So they basically eat a special poo when they're about 6 months old. So can you translate that into a way to help rebuild that microbiome if you're giving a koala antibiotics?
Yeah, so as I said, you know, adult koalas, their microbiomes don't change even if they change diet or even if they're on antibiotics. There can be changes to the microbiome when they're on antibiotics, but it's not connected to their feeding. And so what we've done is we're developing fecal inoculation capsules or probiotics for koalas that is basically packaging up those good microbes from koalas and giving that to koalas receiving antibiotic treatment in hoping to support them through that antibiotic treatment.
Now, I've got a couple of questions coming in. Someone wants to know if perhaps those Tasmanian devils with the facial cancers may be suffering a retrovirus. Has anyone investigated them for that you're aware of? No, this isn't your area, obviously.
I'm not aware of that being a retrovirus. I think the main thing that seems to be the case with the devil facial tumour is just the case of that being a transmissible cancer. We see there's another canine cancer that's transmitted in a similar way, and there's a number of different genetic mutations in that cancer that enables it to do it. But it's a bit of a different story to a retrovirus.
Now, Evie says, oh, our poor koalas, tell us how we can help. Are there particular research and care facilities that it would be best to donate to?
Yeah, so there's a number of different facilities. It depends, you know, where you are in Australia. I work quite closely with Currumbin Wildlife Hospital down in southeast Queensland. They do some really good work, you know, in New South Wales. There's WIRES, there's the Port Macquarie Koala Hospital, there's the Port Stephens Koala Hospital. And then in Victoria and South Australia, there's also several groups down there that you can look up in your local area.
All right, Michaela, thank you. I mean, it's fascinating, but also incredibly sad just thinking about the kind of challenges that the koalas are facing. And I wasn't aware of CORV until now. So just understanding that, it just makes the plight of the koalas seem that much sadder, really. Thank you for explaining all of that to us tonight.
No problem at all. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Michaela Blyton is from the University of Queensland Institute for Bioengineering and for Nanotechnology, just explaining the CORV virus to us and how it works.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.